Welcome to What the Privacy episode. I've got an excellent guest with us today, recommended as well. So hopefully he's going to live up to the hype. Robert Brooker from Altea, a forensic risk management company, digital investigation, fraud tools. Go and check out the website. And Robert Brooker comes with a stellar background. He's just actually gone into Altea as the strategic partnership director. I think that's correct, Robert.
Correct, yeah, it is.
Previously the head of fraud and forensic at PKF, chairman of the London Fraud Forum. He's fraud throughout, and we're just discussing before I started recording a background in TfL, Transport for London, for fraud, which would have been a really interesting job. Hi, Robert. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Andrew, and thank you very much indeed for inviting me on to What the Privacy. I feel privileged, and it's great to be here.
It's quite interesting because Robert's actually based in the same county as me in Shropshire. For those in the States listening, it's in the Midlands, borders Wales, and we never meet anyone from Shropshire in the same industry. How are you getting on with the new role, Robert? Because you've gone from being a consultant in some perspectives straight into a partnership role with a really good company such as Altea. How are you coping with that?
I have. It's really interesting. So I'm a complete practitioner in my whole 25 years within fraud. I'm clearly a foodie, but also a fraudie. And that was my bag. And ultimately, I've known Altea for a while, haven't used their products, and a lot of time for the chief exec, Rob Sinclair, and what they do and how they go about it. And we've often talked about how could we make it work? What could we do? Thankfully, earlier on this year, he said to me, I think I've got something for you. So I stepped across, and it's so exciting. It really is so exciting. A great time to be at Altea. They're growing. The products are been polished and new products to the line. The roadmap looks excellent. And I've got to be honest, I can't speak highly enough of the people. Very hardworking people. We're in every single police force. Our products are in every single police force in the UK. And so I'm just here working now and building partnerships out of law enforcement and see how we can use it across insolvency practitioners, accountancies, lawyers, and any other organisation who investigate whatever it may be. So yeah, really exciting. I'm really enjoying it.
From my knowledge of the police and from my background with projects I worked on and experience working with them, their resource level on actually dealing with fraud, particularly from a cyberspace perspective, I did see a stat, I think it was last year, 0.7% of their resource is focused on cybercrime. They lack the skill sets, they have to outsource to third parties, or as you say, to deploy tools like Altea. They're on a hiding to nothing, aren't they, in some ways?
Indeed, and you're quite right about that figure. That figure was 40% of all crime. 40% of all crime is fraud cyber related. Just think about that for a moment. And less than 1% of policing is dedicated to investigating it. Can you imagine the uproar? And quite rightly, if that would be murder, rape or drugs or something of that nature, I'm sure we'd have a lot more percentage. It's still seen as a victimless crime, Andrew. That's the sad point about it. It's still seen as victimless. Whether it's an individual, he must have had the money to lose, or as a firm, well, they've got plenty of money behind them, they're a big organisation, what harm would that do? And I really sympathise. And until we can change that mindset, linguistics around language and how we treat victims, we're always going to struggle.
I suppose it's the mindset of going from the physical crime to the actual victimless crime. I do remember working in the office at Portland Street, looking at the window and watching Lloyd's Bank get robbed 3 times in 1 week. And you think the police would think, hey, I got a tough job anyway, my father was a policeman. You think that after the first robbery, they'd think they won't do it a second time, but for a third time. But they could cope with that. Most of the cyber crime is high resource, isn't it, on doing the investigation or even just the fraud aspect.
Very much so. And then you go back to the armed robber. You never hear of armed robbery nowadays, Andrew. Never hear of it. Why would you go out and get your hands dirty when I can sit at my mobile phone, my laptop or my iPad or any other tablet or device and just commit fraud? I haven't even got to leave my house. I could still be sat here and doing what I want to do and committing fraud. And it's quite frightening, really. And that's only on the increase. But I think, being really honest, we need to accept fraud's always going to happen. It's what we can do to prevent, deter, detect it. And you're quite right. Learn from what we're doing. And that's where you talk about the 3 bank robberies. And every time you go and present to an audit and assurance committee or a board, can you give me assurance that we don't have any fraud here now today? And it's a difficult one, really, because ultimately it's just like an MOT on a car. It's only as good as that day, depending on what your systems do and how you react to the fraud internally. You've got to make change. You've got to be positive around it. Tone from the top. Deal with it properly. Don't just sweep it under the carpet because it will never go away.
I'm dealing with the insurance market, and I keep on saying to everyone, there's got to be a tipping point on fraud and cybercrime. If you get defrauded by your bank by 10 quid, 20 quid in a Domino's pizza, and then you complain to the bank and they give you the 10 quid back for the pizza, it's cheaper to give me the £10 back, do the investigation. There's got to be a tipping point on the volume, the 40% of crime stat you just gave me, that the banks and all the retailers and manufacturers and everyone else there on the World Wide Web has got to say, we've got to stop this and we've got to act on it. I've got a couple of American customers who say it's got to be that 9/11 scenario, which I think is a bit bizarre analogy. But do you think there's a tipping point where things have got to change?
I do. And I think, to be fair, we've had some new legislation come in at the back end of 2023 with regards to the Economic Crime and Corporate Transparency Act, which is going to change that. For the large corporates particularly, there's now a specific offence for failure to prevent fraud. So you need to have reasonable procedures in place to, otherwise you're going to be subject to very large fines, and obviously that's going to have an impact. The problem with that is you have to have 250 employees, 36 million turnover, or 18 million on the balance sheet. So you need two of those three criteria to fall into that category. That's only, again, 1% of all businesses in the UK, Andrew. So what does that mean for the other 99%? And what does that mean if you're a large corporate who's got a supply chain that's obviously reliant upon delivering your goods or services? What happens with that if something goes wrong in one of those suppliers and actually they end up being the victim of fraud, but it impacts upon your capability and capacity to deliver? So surely as a large corporate or even government departments that are employing all of these subcontractors and contractors, you need to look at what they have in place to help prevent fraud. Because otherwise, nobody's interested in Robert Brooker, or with no respect, Andrew Alston, whoever. It is ABC corporate that have been the victim. Nobody will look at us. They'll only look at the corporates. So that's where I think we will start to see a change, because mindset's got to change. And that's the problem we've got. As you said earlier on, and I've always come back to it, whilst it's seen as a victimless crime, we're going to struggle. And it sadly is still seen as victimless. People tell you that I fell into a fraud. People don't fall into a fraud. There's a whole social engineering piece goes behind people ending up committing fraud. And that social engineering piece is very elongated, becomes very professional. And now let's not even go into AI and deepfakes and everything, because that's just changing it all over again. And you look at it and you think, what can I do? Because ultimately, we've got to do what we can and keep our own house in order and as tight as we possibly can. But you know as well as I do, as we've described already, if they want to do it, they do it. It's like being burgled, isn't it? You put up a 6-foot fence, you get burgled, you put up a 10-foot fence. You get burgled again, you put another padlock on the gate, etc. So you just keep doing that, but you want to try and prevent it in the first place. And unfortunately, as we see regularly, and you know this through cyber attacks, etc., people do succeed. And where does that leave us then?
Yeah, it's the volume. That's why they succeed. So if you think about this, 85,000 terabytes of stolen data out there, sitting out there in the wild, that's publicly available data. All a hacker needs is to run his macro, or they use the words AI now, on a spreadsheet, and they look for a web interface or an email interface, and ping, all they need is one ping, one in a million, and they've succeeded. And don't forget, that's 85,000 terabytes of plain text data. So just imagine how much data that is. It's all about the percentages. And they're being succeeding.
With regards to the traditional fraudster, and you go back to the profile of a fraudster, was generally speaking, with all respect, and I'm quite proud to be there now, but as a middle-aged man, you've been successful in a business, worked your way up through it, been there more than 7, 10, 12 years, and you then would know how everything worked, what the operations were like, and you would be able to commit fraud. And that was the profile of a fraudster. That's completely changed now. And you talk about data, and that's where it is and why it's changed. So what we've got now is teams of late teens, early 20s going into contact centres. And by the way, they're only the foot soldiers, but they're working in a contact centre to steal as much data as they can for the big guys on the organised crime networks. Steal as much data. So we're talking name, address, date of birth, bank account details, etc., etc., etc. And then they're selling it on the dark web. And that's, as you say, the minute you become on the dark web, so you and I hear of your mum, dad, nan, granddad, aunt or uncle, it's non-stop now. They get phone calls from fraudsters, they're getting WhatsApp messages, text messages, emails. That's because now they're on something, and I hate the term, but it's quite right. They call it a sucker list. So all of that data is then sold on the dark web, and it's sold to the fraudsters, and they just then, as you rightly say, that old-fashioned saying of throwing off mud and some will stick, They just keep going and going until people sadly end up taking the bait and they become a victim of fraud.
Yeah, it's often ignored, all that data. We still have a challenge of educating people, making people aware of the threat. And I still think we're on the tip of the iceberg. If you think about what you're doing with the police with Altea and all the other verticals you're working on, your business is only going to grow because there's so much unrecorded crime out there, or there's so much ignored by companies who just take the hit, go back to the tipping point. Your business is only going to increase. This is my view. It'd be good that your CEO must really like me saying that. But that's I don't think nothing's going to change for the next 10, 20 years. And with the advent of the marketing people using the word AI, they've been using AI in the cyber criminal world for years. When you're doing an investigation, how do you go about investigating a suspicious transaction?
And it's interesting that you say that, because many organisations don't realise that they've got transactions going through. And I'll give you a brief example why. But if you look at the whole procure to pay piece, and you look at when you bring somebody on board as a supplier, and then they're working with you, and ultimately you're paying them invoices, etc. There was something called bank mandate fraud, called account diversion fraud, whereby you receive an email telling you that ABC corporate have changed bank account details. And this is still happening to this day. Really quite basic. People just change those bank account details there and then. They change it. No thought process to checking on whether they really have changed them or not. And the only time they know there's a problem is when ABC corporate contacts them, say, we've not been paid. Ultimately, what you end up with is bank diversion fraud, the money being sent to all that next invoice to the fraudsters, and everybody being out of pocket, their reputational risk. This is the thing about fraud. It's not just about money. We all know it takes years to build a reputation and to build a product or a service, and that can just disappear overnight in the competition in the market and looking at who else is there. You look at the impact it had on TalkTalk all those years ago when they had the massive data breach, and you look at the impact that had on them and the data that they lost, you and I as a consumer. I don't want to use that company, do I? I don't want to use a company that's been a victim of fraud. They've got all my data. So you're all of a sudden, and same as transactions, banks know this as well. They're withdrawing that money and you put it somewhere else. You withdraw your services and you take it elsewhere. And that's the bigger picture of the impact of fraudulent transactions and fraudulent behavior. Continuous monitoring, obviously, and you're quite right. And the fraudsters have used AI for years. We're a little bit slow to that, I think. But we're now using AI for continuous monitoring, looking for anomalies and patterns and trends, which helps you obviously then proactively look at financial transactions or any other transaction. But obviously that's only as good as your initial setup and how you get those parameters correct and the patterns are worked out. It's like anything, if you don't actually put the time and effort into setting it up correctly, then you're sorry, but you'll reap what you sow. So therefore that configuration piece at the very beginning is what takes the time and effort and is worth it in the long run.
I'm just going to challenge you on one bit. We were talking about the TalkTalk example. There was millions and millions of people impacted. I think from an awareness and a behavioural aspect, when you see, if I was a TalkTalk user, am I pigeonholing people? I'm just about to do it, but here we go. So I would say, because we're in the industry, you and I would say, I don't want to use TalkTalk anymore. But I think the proportion of the population who use TalkTalk, as an example, would say, oh, it's just fraud. They've got it covered. I'll be all right. I'll still use them. That's the challenge. Whereas maybe the example of Optus or Medicare as in Australia, who had a real ding-dong of a cyber incident. Medicare impact is, from a financial perspective, has taken a big hit and has changed people's behavior. But on a commodity item such as TalkTalk, I don't think it had any impacts. This is my own opinion, observation. Which industry do you think's best set up for fraud? You must be going to say banking. But
yeah,
in your view.
Yeah, you would like to think banking is set up. And let's be honest, we've all seen two-factor / three-factor authentication now, and lots of obviously good processes put in place utilizing voice recognition. And they've done the work in banking to try and prevent. I must admit, I've got to hand it to them, the amount of work they've done. But also, you and I still know it's going on day in, day out. Is there anybody any better or any worse than anybody else? I'm going to sit on the fence a little bit, Andrew, but also say, look at the gambling industry. During lockdown, gambling obviously went through the roof. People had nothing else to do. And the fraudulent behavior around that and setting up accounts and account takeover was huge. And it still is to this day because of the money that can be made. ultimately, they've done a lot of work too. But realistically, would I say anybody's shining a light? Probably not. There's an area at the moment, and this is a little bit controversial, is retail. So if you look at the retail industry, and quite rightly, I get it and I understand why, all of their focus at the moment is on their front door. Because if you look at inner cities, particularly London, Birmingham, Manchester, there are kids, what's known as inverted commas, steaming shops, running in 20s and 30s, picking up as many high value goods as I can and just running out. Do you know the problem with that? And I know why they're putting all of their time, effort and resources to it. Because sadly, and I mean this genuinely, sadly, members of staff are getting injured during those attacks. But do you know what? They're taking their eye off the ball of their various platforms whereby they're selling online. And the fraud on there far outweighs the amount they're losing through the front door. But ultimately, it's to do with safety of their own staff, and I get it. But I think they need to refocus and start concentrating a little bit on their online platforms as well, because there's so many different channels that they're selling through, and they really are really, really suffering.
So how do you empower an organisation to make their place of work safer or their activities safer?
So that's out-and-out theft that we've just described. But let's talk about fraud specifically as opposed to theft, which is obviously a very different animal in that it's physical as opposed to the majority of fraud nowadays, as you rightly say, is online and cyber committed. And what that's about is we talk tone from the top. And I don't just mean the chief executive and managing director. I mean the whole of senior leadership, the executive board, the non-executive board. And what do we mean by tone from the top? It's a very loosely used term. But what we mean is, so we talk about fraud happening in an environment, in any of our workplaces. What do? We've got three options, haven't we, really? We dismiss the person, we recover the money, or we can prosecute. And the problem we're getting, and I see it so regularly nowadays, is we're just happy to push them out the back door quietly. If you publicised internally that you'd actually dismissed these two people, don't have to name them, that doesn't matter, but you actually have done some positivity around it. Because if I'm sitting there committing fraud at the moment, and I've seen two people go, and all that happens is they got pushed out the back door quietly at 9 o'clock in the morning, no one knew any different. Do you know what? I'm not going to stop committing fraud, am I? I'll just carry on. Whereas actually, if you make that tone from the top and you change that culture and those behaviours with consequences for those behaviours, then you've got a chance of actually preventing and deterring people from committing more fraud. I give you an example. I did just an expenses fraud, and somebody including their wife for holidays and guy on flights and goodness knows what else. And what we noticed is once we announced it internally, the expenses for the next 3 months absolutely nosedived, where it had that impact on people to think, whoa, I've got to be straight here. I've got to be very clear and very specific around my expenses because they're obviously looking. Don't get me wrong. After 3 months, there was a bit of complacency and it starts to rise again. But I think that's a prime example, is that you need to have that tone from the top, and it's around behaviours, culture, but consequences for that, and making sure you're monitoring it and working as a team on it. Because so far too often, A, we're relying on one person, i.e. you're the chief executive, it's got to come from you, or B, we're not actually embracing that whole culture across the organisation.
Do you think the brand and the protection of the brand is more important than reporting the fraud to the team, because they want to make sure that this is a trustworthy brand to work for? It's like some companies, like the new SEC rules out in the States on reporting breaches. In some cases, they don't report a breach until they have to. You're always trying to protect the brand, so you don't want bad news. So when I used to work for this large IT company, which people who know me know whose it is, some guy got done for fraudulent activity. They shoved him out the back door. We all knew he'd gone, but they didn't want to announce it because it was bad PR.
Exactly. And that wasn't a deterrence to anyone else that happened to be doing it, was it, Andrew? That's the sad thing. So there is no deterrence there. So back to your point is, you're quite right, is you have to work together to prevent and detect and deter. And ultimately, if you're not doing that, I'm afraid you're kind of really wasting your time, effort and money that you're putting into it, because you're not going to deter anybody else.
So these deterring of people to commit fraud, is that more of an educational aspect? Is that more of a monitoring approach? Because you don't want to reduce the burden on your own technical resources and reliance on your own capability on managing fraud. You want to make sure the people you're employing understand what their remit is.
It's A, representing and respecting the brand, as you alluded to earlier, and who you're working for and what you're doing. And that's positive, and publicity that they get would be great. People is the big factor here. And we talk about the insider threat. And the minute you've got staff, you've got a risk. And you're quite right, is that what they're able to do, and listen, I get it to an extent. There's two types of fraudster, the greed and the need. The need is whereby, obviously, you need it for a roof over your head and food on the table. And the greed is because you want to live the high life because you have an addiction or extramarital or whatever it may be. And that, as a business, is what you need to do and what you need to manage. And the education awareness piece, how many times do we hear, and compliance, you're quite right, and that depends whether you're in the regulated sector or the non-regulated sector more and more to this day. You get an induction and it includes fraud training. Do you know what? I've never had another one since. And people have been there 3, 5, 7, 10 years, whatever. And that's the thing. It's just, it has to be annual. And I love the education, awareness and training because it reminds people. And in your world, I've seen it at most companies I've been at, whereby you send a spoof email purporting to be either the chief exec, can you pay this now? Or you purport to be whatever other, like click on this link and you get win yourself 500 quid voucher. And the amount of people that still fall for that. But you know what? If you're running that program regularly and you run that every month, all of a sudden those numbers dwindle greatly because people start to take responsibility and start to look at those emails and right click and see who it's from and all that kind of thing. And ultimately, that's how you're going to do it, is the education and awareness. But it has to be real life. It has to be something you can relate to. So when I do the biggest example, how many organizations even recognize fraud as a strategic risk? And we've just talked about 40% of all crime is fraud, cyber fraud related. So actually, until you know what your risks are, how can you expect to manage them and then to mitigate against them? So I think the very early stage is understanding where your risks lie. That gives you an opportunity to then prevent, detect, deter. Otherwise, you're just doing that as the horse has bolted, Andrew, and just literally reactive rather than being proactive.
I've got a good example on potential fraud. We've got a brilliant customer who phoned me up, it's partner actually, and he said, what do you think about, because one of their organizations had been found on a gambling website which had been compromised, and he wanted to articulate the message back to his client. And I said, well, the thing is, when you look at someone who's been compromised, said on a third-party website using a work email address on a gaming website, well, one, there's a few things you got to go through your head. One's not to panic. It's all about problem management. Why is that person using his email address to go on a gaming website? Fine, that's, you know, that's verbatim, you'd say that. But the things I would say is, what position is he in within that organization? Does he have money problems? Does he have home problems? Is he in a position where he might have access to money? That's the sort of investigation you have to do and to understand why he's on a gaming website. Does he have a gambling addiction? So all these things you've got to go through, and you've got to look at it as a positive because you're there to help that person. They might have some well-being problems. I bet the productivity is a bit low, but I mean, so it's all that, but it's all that information management, it's all that understanding, it's all that problem management, it's all the simple steps you do on investigating things or just making people aware. So when I spoke to him, he went back to his end client, and they went, you know, you have to get HR involved. There's so much insight, particularly on your investigation aspect from what you do or your understanding. When you see fraud, what steps do you do now in order to do the remedial stuff? How do you start off the investigation?
That's about being a caring employer as well, what you just referred to. It really is. It's really around the employer, and you're building back to that culture and that behaviours, and you're helping those build that. In terms of a fraud, depends what it is. What's the first thing you're going to do? What evidence have you been provided with that it's a fraud? What evidence can we go and get to see whether it's a fraud or otherwise? Everything that points towards it being an offence, and everything that points away from it being an offence.
Yeah.
And listen, in this day and age, as you know, and I know this is your world more than mine, really, is computer forensics play a massive part in the early days of an investigation. I want to look at emails. I want to look at mobile phones. I want to look at WhatsApp messages, Discord, Telegraph, wherever else they're on. So what we're first doing in many cases is we are coming in and we're taking drives, we're taking laptops, we're taking mobile phones, downloading that data, and then we're going through all of those messages using keywords, etc. I'm sure many on here know exactly what I'm referring to. And you start to look for whether Robert Brooker, Andrew Alston are mentioned and what conversations have gone on to lead towards the fraud. Once we've got that, and we've now got ourselves in a position where we can corroborate evidence to match some of those messages or emails that we've found, and we can go out and get witness statements and we can get the evidence to go with that, then when you get ourselves into it, and this is in a real nutshell, very quick run through, get yourselves in a position whereby we've got witness statements, we've got evidence to corroborate, I can now interview and speak to the individual. and ultimately everything going to it, and it's their opportunity to give you their side of the fence. But the biggest problem that organizations have when a fraud goes wrong in the very first place, before we get to that stage, is a response plan. Not many organizations have a response plan. What happens if a fraud occurs? Who takes responsibility? What happens to that individual as a member of staff? What happens to the line manager of that individual? What should I expect as the actual suspect myself? And what should I be doing as a corporate board or the leadership team? What should we be doing and who should be doing what? And that's the most important piece, and where it becomes, as you described earlier, it becomes a completely chaotic otherwise, because nobody knows. And this is the other thing. Where does fraud sit in an organization? Is it HR? Is it legal? Is it compliance? Is it finance? And now I've seen it across all of them. I'm not saying there's a right or a wrong. It might even be audit if you have an internal audit department. But you need to understand who owns what, who's responsible for what, and then we can start to investigate. And that early piece is around corroboration of evidence and having a look at whether, because let's be honest, sadly, there are still vexatious allegations of fraud happen all the time. And actually, it's not that clear. You need to corroborate whether it is correct or not, and what information have you been provided? What evidence have they given you in the very first place, and where did that come from? And then ultimately be able to look across the business and third parties and start to actually look deeper into it. And as you rightly say, that's in a nutshell, and also is like an outline, very broad brush of the way you would go about it.
So what would you recommend to organisations to undertake to reduce the fraud? What steps?
First of all, is that education, awareness, training. That's the purely very first step. Yeah. Very first step. Yeah. I'll tell you why. I wrote an article on this, and it's a real-life situation whereby a finance director told me, I have no fraud here. I find that amazing in this day and age. What? How are you so confident telling me you have no fraud? I said, how much education and awareness you do? Well, I don't. He said, what do I want to tell them how to do it for? I said, we're not educating people.
What does that education take form of? Is it just a lesson? Is it an online course? Or is it someone coming around to just talk
in person?
To them?
It could be in person, it could be online, it could be on the internet. You need a heartbeat every couple of weeks, month, throughout your organisation to tell you of A, what's going on in the industry, B, what's going on in your own organisation, C, fraud in general, and what we should be looking out for. And ultimately, then you're getting people to think about fraud at work, and then they'll think about fraud in their home life. It's not all about work. Get people thinking about fraud in their day-to-day life, and you'll transfer that into what you're doing at work. I'm a firm believer in that. So for me, education awareness, online, in person, and what do we mean by that? It's what is fraud? What is the legislation? What does it mean to you in your organisation? What are our risks where we are? You put yourselves in the shoes of a fraudster doing your job. Where would you commit fraud? And it's that kind of education and awareness, getting people thinking about it, and then you have to back that up with that tone from the top. Otherwise, it's pointless.
And it's getting that education awareness down the food chain, down to the SMEs, where 99% of the organisations happen. But if you start somewhere and you take that education back to home, to the kids and everything, because my whole family all over the UK know what to do, not what to do. It's that simple step. Yeah, we do get caught out, but education is so just fundamentally important. One of the good things that I see in the UK, and apologies to every other country out there in the world, is that I've banged on about this, that the 52% of the schools in the UK have a cybersecurity response plan or a cybersecurity strategy. That's far more than any business in the UK. They might not have the skill sets or the resource, but at least they're trying to actually do something. I'm a firm believer of what you say, Robert. I always stem back to education awareness. If we can get it, we can bottle it at the beginning and then keep on reminding people, and then it becomes second nature.
Isn't there a saying, if you do something 10 times continually, it becomes a habit and you just do it without even thinking? And I think it's 10 times. So that's even you and I about putting, you know, it's like at home, the wife moans, you don't put your cup away or something, you've had a cup of tea. If you do it 10 times, that's it. Well, after we've been together 35 years, so I think I'm probably entitled now. But I still haven't learned, Andrew.
Nor am I. I was just about to say that. They just changed the bins where we live. We've been here 28 years. They changed the bins from a Monday night. We have to put them out to a Thursday night. So 28 years of bins going out on Monday night, and I still haven't been trained for the Thursday. It's just a nightmare.
You either miss it completely, or you. miss it completely or put it out on a Monday anyway.
Well, yeah, you know what the bins are like in Shropshire. You have so many bins, it gets need a Chinese puzzle to work out which bin to go out.
And what goes in what one, not to mention woe betide you if you leave the lid up. Oh, you'll never get your rubbish clear. Well, I heard that conversation recently.
I didn't realise we'd finish off a great podcast on What the Privacy with you, talking about the bins that go out. I do know that my American customers like me to say rubbish bins because they don't use the word rubbish. But
it's
been a pleasure. Or garbage, that's it. It's been a pleasure speaking to you, to Robert. Check him out on LinkedIn and also check out Altio.com. Some really interesting stuff on their website on how they do investigations and the tool sets and everything. Be great to meet you in person, Robert.
Running down the road. Look forward to it.
Yeah, we should do that. Thanks for your time, Robert.
Thank you very much indeed for having me. It's been great fun, and I hope that at least there's one or two takeaways in there for the listeners.
Brilliant. No, it's been really interesting, and I've learned a bit. Well, I've learned a lot, I should say. Bye.
Cheers, mate.